there's no perfect system, but which system protects the rights of as many people as possible? That's what you have to consider.
Welcome to the Know Why podcast. I'm your host, Liberty McCarter. For many of us, it's not enough to know what people say about life's most important questions. We also want to know why. Each week, Know Why tackles tough questions on topics ranging from spirituality to current events. While we approach these issues from a Christian perspective, we discuss diverse opinions and ultimately dive into what the research says. Are you ready to know why? Let's get started. Welcome to the Know Why podcast. Today, in our Know About Political Engagement series, we're going to discuss something that has been a point of confusion, controversy, and even consternation for many people over many generations, and that is the Electoral College. The Electoral College is pretty important to understand, however, because it ultimately determines the outcome of our presidential elections every 4 years. And obviously, we're recording this in 2024. We've got an election coming up in a few months, so it's relevant, and a lot of people may be thinking about it this year. So if you've ever felt confused about the Electoral College or conflicted about it, you'll want to keep listening. There are a lot of opinions about the Electoral College, and we want to help you know why the United States has the Electoral College so that you can ultimately form your own informed opinion and know why you believe what you believe about it. And to explain all of this to us is our returning guest, Richard Lim. Thank you for joining us today, Richard.
It's good to be here. Thank you.
Richard is the host and co-founder of This American President, which is a history podcast that delves into the lives and legacies of U.S. presidents through long-form stories and interviews. It's really good. You should listen to it. Richard also previously served at the White House and at George Washington's Mount Vernon estate, and he regularly appears on various shows and in publications talking and writing about U.S. history. So thanks again, Richard, for being here. And as you know, the Electoral College is controversial, especially right now. There are a lot of people today who call for its abolition, saying that it's outdated, and other people say it's absolutely essential to our system of government. But before we kind of get into different opinions about it, can you just explain to us what it is and how it works?
Yeah, exactly. So the Electoral College, very simply, it is consisting of the people who technically do the actual voting for president. They do the actual choosing the president for us. They're basically a body of people that are chosen through a combination of the political parties making their selection and the voters making their selection. And they choose who gets to vote for president in the Electoral College. And there are a lot of different reasons for why it exists. I'm happy to get into that. But that is basically what it is. They're doing the actual voting. So when you vote for president, there's this idea that, okay, you have your ballot and you're going to vote for either Donald Trump or Joe Biden. But in reality, what you're doing is you're voting for members of the Electoral College to vote for Donald Trump or Joe Biden. So the next time you look at your ballot in the general election, notice that you're not directly choosing the president. You're choosing electors to vote for the candidate.
I could be wrong on this, but aren't there different numbers of electors per state? Is that how it works?
Yes, exactly. So the number of members of the Electoral College a state has is dependent on how many members of Congress they have and how many senators they have. So if a state, there are certain states that don't have the least populous states, they'll have maybe one member of Congress, but every state has two senators. So those states will have at least three members of the Electoral College. Now, if you for those who know their history, they know that we have a House and a Senate. We have two chambers of Congress. And the reason those two chambers exist is because it's a compromise between the big states and the small states. During the Constitutional Convention, the founders wanted, they were debating over representation, and the big states wanted a Congress based on population. And so that would benefit the big states. and the small states wanted equal representation for everybody, and that would obviously be weighted in favor of the small states. Well, the founders decided, let's compromise and have one chamber that reflects both, and the Electoral College reflects that compromise. It's a way of balancing the interests of big states and small by saying that the number of representatives every state has in the Electoral College is based on the number of representatives it has in both chambers. So again, it's a reflection of balancing between the big states and the small states.
And then what's the total number of electors?
There are 538 members of the Electoral College. So there are 435 members of the House of Representatives. There are 100 senators, so that gets us to 535, equal to the total of every member of Congress, House or Senate. And then you have to add 3 electoral votes for the ones in Washington, D.C. In the 70s, D.C. was granted electoral votes. So that goes from 535 to 538. And in the United States, we believe in majority rule. So in order to win the presidency, you need a majority of 538 votes, which is 270. That's the magic number, 270.
So interesting. So many numbers. And for, you know, some people maybe who they're just now old enough to really vote or they're learning about all of this, it can seem like, you know, this is so confusing. Is this more complicated than necessary? But as you described earlier, it was actually a compromise to make sure that both big states and smaller states were represented. But I know that one critique of the Electoral College or concern that a lot of people have today is that if they live in a state that, you know, votes majority Republican, so, you know, a red state, and most of the time, you know, it always goes Republican, but they're a Democrat or vice versa, that their individual vote won't count because it really won't affect the electors and what they are bound to vote for anyways. So can you address that concern?
Yeah, sure. And it's a completely legitimate question to ask. Before I get into that, I also wanted to point out the notion that the reason why we don't have popular vote goes back to the decision the founders had to create a republic and not a democracy or a pure democracy. The founding fathers studied what were essentially models of pure democracy, and that was the most famous one is ancient Greece. And in that system, basically every citizen, which meant basically a male, you know, usually landowning of some level of class, participated and voted on every law. But what they found was that in systems like that, it was very easy for demagogues to take over and convince the people. I mean, the system's only good as the people that run it. And they found that the people were often susceptible to demagogues. They often think more in the short term than in the long term. And that's why they rejected a democracy and said, okay, look, the people are busy. They need to elect representatives to represent them and work on this and think more deeply about these issues of laws. And so that's why they created a republic. So if you think about it, the same way people vote for members of Congress, you and I don't vote on all the laws, right? We're citizens, but we don't vote on all the laws. We vote for, I mean, there are exceptions, but what we do is we vote for people to then vote for the laws. And that's the same principle here. The Electoral College was meant to be a representative body where the people who are busy and have to be on the farm and do all this hard work, they go and vote for people who then have the time to go and vote for president and think through, okay, who's the best candidate. So if anyone doesn't like the principle of not voting directly for president, but it's the same thing with laws. We generally don't vote, you know, directly for laws. Now you were asking about, is it fair? You know, someone lives in a red state and votes Democrat, they feel like their vote doesn't count and vice versa. Well, so I would say a few things. First of all, the popular vote system, if we were to go to a system where it's based on popular vote, your vote would be competing with the other 300, well, I guess let's say over 100 million people across the country that are voting. Mm-hmm. And in that case, what would happen is that a given presidential candidate would have incentive to only go to the cities to scoop up as many votes as possible. So, yes, if you're a Democrat in a red state or vice versa, you're obviously going to feel outvoted. But the thing is that you're at least competing with a smaller pool of voters than you would otherwise. You would be competing with who knows how many people. And the other thing, too, is that people always talk about how candidates only focus on the swing states rather than the country as a whole. But the thing is, swing states change over time. There was a time where Virginia was very conservative, but now it's leaning blue. California voted for George H.W. Bush in 1988. Mm-hmm. Obviously it's very blue now, but the thing is that things do change over time. But imagine if it was based on popular vote, and then your vote would count even less because people would go to the cities, which are predominantly Democrat. And you'd be competing with that. And so I would say you have to look at alternatives. There's no perfect system, but which system protects the rights of as many people as possible? That's what you have to consider.
Yeah. Wow. There's so much there to think about. That's all so interesting. And I really like how you pointed out too the difference between, a pure democracy and having a republic, and how that actually gives more people more of a voice. And so if I'm understanding that right, like basically what we're preventing in one way is mob rule, or where, like you said, candidates might just go to like the huge cities or metropolitan areas because they know that that's where the most people live. And if they can convince all those people of something, of a law or a candidate or whatever, they could vote for that. But the people who maybe are in the minority, their vote really doesn't matter as much as it actually does matter now. That's super fascinating. And I think a lot of people maybe don't think about the fact that their vote maybe is protected more in this system.
Well, the other thing I want to point out, there are two other aspects of the Electoral College. The first is that the Electoral College doesn't honestly really matter unless it's really, really close. Because what you find is that if a candidate is going to win in a landslide, let's say they're going to win 60% of the vote, the Electoral College essentially ratifies that decision. If someone is able to win that vote, they have so much support across the country, they're going to win the Electoral College. It's a statistical probability that they're going to win in a landslide. In fact, Reagan won 59% of the vote in 1984, but he won 49 out of 50 states. He won over 520 electoral votes out of 538.
Wow.
So the Electoral College doesn't alter that. But what happens is that when it's close, what the Electoral College does is that it forces a candidate to care about a lot of states, and it forces a candidate to have to win states in different regions of the country. Because if you can't just win the cities, you're going to have to, if you're a Democrat, you're going to have to win some purple and maybe a red state or two. And if you're a Republican, you're going to have to win, some purple and blue and a blue state here and there. And so what that does is that it forces the candidate to say, okay, if I'm a Democrat, I can't just hang out in New York. I have to also go to the Midwest. I have to go to the, maybe grab a vote or two in the Rocky Mountains. It forces that, and, mm-hmm. and vice versa. So a lot of the candidates that lost the electoral vote but won the popular vote, what you find is that they actually weren't able to win enough states in different places. In 2000, we can get into this later, but in 2000, Al Gore lost the election. But he only won, I think, like 19 votes. If he would have won Florida, he would have won just 20 out of 50 votes. That's the reason why he lost, was because he couldn't expand the map, and he couldn't hold what Clinton had won. And so That's the real reason. The other thing I want to point out is that think about the 2000 election. We had a recount, and that was a recount in Florida because the vote there was so close, right? Well, we had that recount. It was crazy. And Bush won. And he won by 537 votes out of 6 million casts. Wow. Bush essentially won the presidency by 537 votes out of 6 million in Florida and 100 million across the nation. And in that situation, people's votes in Florida really mattered. You know, a person in Florida might say the vote doesn't matter, but actually it did. Now, if we had a system based on popular vote and the election was close and it wasn't based on states, we would have had to recount an entire popular vote. We would have had to recount 100 million votes, as opposed to having a recount in one state with 6 million votes, which is a lot more manageable. And if we were to have a popular vote, we basically would give incentive to any candidate who, let's say you lose the popular vote by less than a percentage point, and you could say, hey, the other side cheated, let's have a recount. And if they end up having a recount, you'd have this disaster of a national recount of 100 million votes, 100 million plus, and the legitimacy of the president would be questioned. And if you look, this isn't theoretical, if you look around the world, this has happened. Mexico, in I believe it was 2006, had a national election. I mean, they have a popular vote system, and they had a national recount because that's what happens. You know, if it's a close election, there's an incentive to call for a national recount. And it was a cluster, and it ended up undermining the legitimacy of the person entering office. But if you look at Florida, you know, most people said, okay, Bush won and it was controversial, but most people accepted him as president because the legitimacy wasn't undermined. So when you think popular vote, imagine national recount of 120 or whatever number of people vote, 120 million people voting, as opposed to just a state recount.
Wow.
And that's what you could have. Yes.
Wow. Yeah. I've never thought about that. I feel like we would just be recounting all the time. And that is such a good point.
One of the things about America that people take for granted is that we have this incredibly stable system that we've had regular elections since 1788, 1789, when Washington was elected. And that's unparalleled. That's a record that is unparalleled in human history, where you have every 4 years, you have a presidential election. Every 2 years, you have House elections and Senate elections. And, you know, the Senate is staggered. So, you know, a third get elected every 2 years. So with all that said, there's a reason why we have that stability. And it's because we have systems like the Electoral College that prevent disastrous national recounts.
Yeah. Wow. And yes, such a good point about how truly blessed we are in the United States to have that stability, because that is not the norm around the world. And even when I know that, you know, in my adult life, when I've been able to vote, and even when, you know, the presidential candidate that I didn't vote for goes into office, I still am just like thankful whenever there's a peaceful transfer of power, because I realize, you know what, this is not how it is around the world for a lot of people, for most people, I think. And so the fact that we can have that peaceful transfer of power and that we have those consistent elections is just something to remember to be thankful for. So you've already mentioned the election in 2000, but I know that in 2016, people were upset again with the Electoral College playing a really, you know, controversial role in the outcome of the presidential election. So just from a history standpoint, what are some other examples where maybe the popular vote has differed from the outcome in the Electoral College?
Yeah, well, I mean, how much of that was just because the people who were upset, their candidate lost? You know, I mean, a lot of these people would probably love the Electoral College if their candidate lost the popular vote but won the electoral vote. And the other thing that I always get entertained by is when someone loses the popular vote, when someone wins the popular vote but loses the electoral vote, and they keep saying, hey, I won the popular vote. And it's like, well, okay, but nobody, like, that wasn't when you signed up to win this election, to run in this election, you did not say, I'm signing up to win the popular vote. You said you're signing up to win the electoral vote. So it's really a race that no one's running to win the popular vote. But anyways, we've had 5 presidential elections in which the candidate with the most the most popular votes did not win the electoral college. That was in 1824, 1876, 1888, 2000, 2016. And so that's 2 in the last 24 years. Now, with all that said, I think one of the most interesting ones is the 1824 election, because Andrew Jackson won the popular vote and he actually got the most electoral votes, but he didn't win a majority. And that because there were 4 candidates running and he wasn't able to consolidate enough support to win the majority. Now, what happened then, per the Constitution, is that that election went to the Congress, and that's its own discussion. But basically, when no one gets a majority of electoral votes, the election then goes to Congress, in which the president is chosen by the House of Representatives, and the Senate is chosen by the Senate chooses the vice president. And here's another wrinkle: in such an election in the House, the president isn't chosen by a majority vote of members of Congress. What happens is that every state delegation in the House becomes just one vote. And so like California has, 55 members of Congress in the House, California would just get one vote. And all those members of, the 55 would have to just vote as one, whoever wins the majority of those 55, they get that one vote of California. But anyways, so it's a bit of a complicated system, but in that system, you had a lot of politicking, and John Quincy Adams emerges as the winner because one of the candidates bows out. And Jackson cried foul, said there was a corrupt bargain. Historians debate about whether that was true or not. But the point isn't that John Quincy Adams won, how terrible. The point is that Andrew Jackson failed to win a majority of electoral votes. He failed to win it. Sorry. And when that happens, it goes to the House. And so that was a very interesting situation. But it proves, again, that if you can't win a majority of electoral votes, you're still not the president. And, we have this system that forces you to win a majority of the representatives in the college that are chosen by the people. 1876 is a fascinating election because that was the closest of all time, 185 to 184 in the Electoral College vote. I actually have an episode about it on my podcast called Fake News and Nasty Men. So if you want to learn more about that, there's that. But that was a crazy election. But what this all comes down to is that whoever won the popular vote but lost the Electoral College, they won the popular vote because they were able to secure their own states by a wide margin. It's like the Democrats winning California. Okay, great. You won the bluest of bluest states.
Right.
But can you win purple states and a red state? And that's why those candidates weren't able to pull it off. That's why Hillary Clinton didn't pull it off. She won the popular vote. Great. You held on to New York and California, but you didn't win those Midwestern states. That's what Donald Trump did, or a lot of those Midwestern states. So that's where that comes into play.
Wow. So interesting. And, yeah, it can sound complicated, but if it was easier, then I feel like you said, it might undermine the legitimacy. And becoming president of the United States, like, that should be hard. You should have to try to, win people over that aren't necessarily your core voter base, like you're talking about, win some of those purple states, go and win, the state that doesn't normally vote for your party. It shouldn't just be easy to become president of the United States or to gain power. And so even though a lot of this seems complicated and you have to get a majority and you have to get this many, and then if this happens, you have to do this, that's put in place to protect us from, people just grabbing power all the time.
I want a presidential candidate to not just go to New York and Florida, but I want them to go to Iowa. I want them to go to Arizona. I want them to have to go to all these states and meet the individuals there. You know, Bill Clinton, you know, there's a similar debate about the primaries, because people are upset that, you know, certain primaries happen before others. And, you know, Iowa has the first caucus and New Hampshire has the first primary. And therefore, hey, what, you know, what about our state? Shouldn't we be first? And it's like, okay, you know, that's a fair question. But the thing is, if you had a national primary where every state voted at the same time, candidates wouldn't go to certain states and get to know individual people. They would have to force to deal with the people as a whole. And it would just be, they would just give speeches at, you know, again, populous areas. And Bill Clinton, who I'm not a fan of, once said, look, with when you have a system like the Iowa caucus, where you know, certain states go first, it forces candidates like me to go to Iowa and talk to people and really get to know them personally. And he said that that process made me a better candidate and a better president, for what that's worth, because it showed me, like, I had to actually learn about the problems of everyday people, as opposed to having to learn, as opposed to just giving speeches to millions of people without actually getting to know them personally, which would happen under a national primary. So, yeah, there's a reason why this happens. You know, why we have the system we do.
Be sure to tune in next week to catch part two of our interview with Richard Lim. And don't forget to visit knowwhypodcast.com for more episodes, information, and resources. Thanks for listening.